into conflict, though, right away. Today's session, we are calling The Plot Thickens. And you will recall, at our last exciting session before the commercial break, which took all day yesterday, that we had tried to describe how in chapter 1, Jesus' identity is established for the readers, but that it is not clear to the public yet who he is. Chapter 2 began to show that there was a group of opponents also developing who were generally characterized, I suppose we could call them, authorities, officialdom, scribes, Pharisees. The only people that seemed to know who Jesus was, the only entities, beings who knew who Jesus was, were the demons, who were a part of that world that would understand the spiritual dimensions of his mission better than the people would. We got to 3:6, chapter 3, verse 6. And what we're going to do is I'm going to try to summarize, and you can kind of follow along, what happens in chapter 3. Then we're going to do some more specific studies in chapters 4 and 5. And then I'll do a little summary. It'll get us into 6, and it'll be coffee break. Now, we could pick up at 3:7, and the section between 3 verse 7 and 3:12 is a very good summary of what we talked about yesterday, convenient. It begins by showing that Jesus now has gathered a crowd. And one of the things we're going to discover today, as we look at Jesus' increasing popularity and Jesus' increasing power, is the conflict between, it's kind of an escalation day, where on one side, Jesus becomes more aggressive about his ministry, and on the other, the opposition begins to get a little more aggressive. So we have here a large crowd. That's going to be characteristic today, the term crowds. We're going to hear that often. They come from, and Mark here takes the time to tell where they come from. And it's interesting to ask, why does he take all this space to describe the territories? If you plotted those on a map, and if I had an overhead map, I would do it for you, but you can think of your map of Palestine that we all carry around from Sunday school days in our heads, I suppose. The territory goes from up around Tyre and Sidon, up in the north, all the way down on both sides of the Jordan, down to the Negev, down to the desert in the south. And in fact, almost scrupulously covers the territory that was occupied by the 12 tribes. In the south, the southernmost tribe of Israel in the Old Testament was Simeon. The north, up there by Tyre and Sidon, Issachar, Naphtali. Across the Jordan, the east side of the Jordan, present-day Jordan, there were also tribes of Israel. Can't remember. Issachar was one of the other. Gad, I think, is over there. Manasseh east, and so on. There were three or so tribes on that side. So, it seems to cover the area covered by the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, this crowd comes because they hear of the things Jesus is doing. There's a tremendous crush of people, so he has to put out in a boat to teach them. And he would heal people, casting out evil spirits. And you notice there in verse 11, whenever the evil spirits saw him, they would fall down and scream, "You are the Son of God." I mean, again, it's the demons still making the identity. But Jesus, in verse 12, sternly orders them not to tell anyone who he was. Now, that was where we left ourselves yesterday, remember, was saying, why is this? And we wanted to keep that thought in mind. We will. We won't get it solved today, but I'm hoping that tomorrow it will become clearer. We had some hints of it yesterday, and so you can think about those ideas because they will show up again. Okay, so we've got people from all over Israel. Now, in the next section, verses 13 through 19, Jesus chooses 12 apostles. Now remember, he had already, we had read earlier that four had been selected and Levi had been added, but now we get the full list of 12, and he tells them that they are going to be sent out to preach and authority to drive out demons, which has been Jesus' ministry up to this point, basically, preaching and casting out evil spirits. But notice now the 12. We have just heard about people coming from the territory of the 12 tribes, and now we have 12 apostles. Let's just think for a minute that this may be a symbol of Jesus now creating for himself a new Israel. And the number 12 is important for that reason, because it has that symbolic nature to it. So Jesus begins to create a community. Meanwhile, what does the community think of Jesus? Well, that's the next section. We get the other side of the coin, verses 20 through 30. When Jesus returns home, and notice there's still a crowd, his family hears about it and also hears that there is now an explanation for Jesus' behavior. Namely, he's gone mad, verse 21. Now they figured him out. He's crazy. Or, put in their language, he has an evil spirit. Notice the next verse. Some teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem, they were the experts. They'd come from headquarters and they knew about these things. He has Beelzebul in him. So, how can he cast out demons? Simple. He's got one himself. He's got a big one. Beelzebul, prince of demons, so he can handle little ones. Beelzebul may mean lord of the house. Anyway, whatever the term originally meant, Jesus now confronts these people and says, think about it. Can a demon cast out a demon? Is Satan divided? And then, if indeed Beelzebul means lord of the house, that would help us explain verse 27. No one can break into a strong man's house and take away his belongings. At first he ties up the strong man, then he can plunder the house. And then Jesus responds, if you think I have an evil spirit, then you are in fact sinning against the Spirit of God, and there's no help for you. So you see, we're escalating the conflict now a little bit. Jesus says there's no way you can be forgiven if you do not accept my mission as, or the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit, as speaking or working through me. But in fact, there's a lot of doubt, as the next passage indicates. Jesus' mothers and brothers finally get to him. It's hard to get to him, note verse 32. There's that crowd again. Crowd is in the way, but they say, okay, your mother and brothers have come, and they want you. Presumably to take him home and keep him quiet. Give him some hot soup or something and calm him down. But now Jesus has, begun this separation from the people who do not believe. See, it's getting hardball now, so to speak. The family says, okay, we really think he's not crazy, at least he's embarrassing. So let's get him home. And Jesus says, in effect, I am no longer linked by blood to this group. Who are my mother and my brothers, he asks. And then he looks at the people and says, whoever does what God wants him to do is my brother, my sister, my mother. He has, in a sense, now declared a new family, just as he has presumably set up a new Israel. At least he's gotten 12 apostles. So, things are beginning to look a little grim. It's no longer just talk. Now we begin to have some organization coming in. At this point, then, Jesus teaches the crowd. And chapter 4 is a series of parables, all familiar to you, but usually taken separately because we're talking about one thing or another, or it's church, and we can't do that. We can't do a whole chapter on Sunday. So we do one parable at a time. But let's look at chapter 4 as a series of four illustrations now of what is happening. I've called this interpreting the conflict. Because we can look at chapter 4 as a way of Jesus explaining to them why things aren't turning out the way we would have programmed it. We would think, at least people are told all the time, if you're a Christian, everything's going to be great. People will love you, you will be popular, you will have all the good things in life you want. Well, the disciples or the crowd was now discovering that there's a lot of conflict. And if any of you have followed religious movements of any sort, you know that that always happens. And people are thrown in the condition of asking, are we on the right side or aren't we? So if there are four parables here now, the questions we want to ask is, how do these parables interpret what is happening to Jesus? So that his followers would understand the strange reaction that's happening. Instead of peace, peace, there seems to be now an escalating conflict. And let's remember that these stories are gathered after the resurrection, so we can ask also, how do these parables interpret what was happening to the early Christian church? Because it's clear that they are saying, well, if it happened to Jesus, it might well still be happening to us. So we have four parables, and I haven't given them names here, but we'll do that because they're all familiar to you. And I'm going to ask you again to cover it. I think that worked pretty well yesterday. And so this time, let's ask this group down here to be number one. You've got a long parable. Almost always in Mark, the teachings of Jesus, the first is the longest, and then there are sort of a series of groups afterwards. So you've got a long one. You might get started on that now. 1 to 20, sort of this bunch of people over here. This next bunch of people in the middle, just between the two pillars, you take 21 to 25. It's a hard one. It's going to be hard. You've got the hardest job. Three, let's take this group over here. You do 26 to 29. And if there's anybody in heaven today, there's some up there, sure. 30 to 32, 430 to 32. And the questions are, how do these parables interpret what's happening to Jesus? And how do they help interpret what's happened to the early Christian church? So take a few minutes, just read it, and then we'll kind of pick up your responses. Okay, we're going to start with the people up in the balcony. Because like the kingdom of heaven, last shall be first. Well, okay, you're familiar, you've got a familiar parable up there. Parable,
mustard seed
parable. Okay, how does it help interpret what we've been saying? How would people who heard that parable apply it to the situation they saw around them, would you say? Thank you. I hear rustling up there.
Doesn't look like much now, but just wait.
Okay, it's a contrast between size of mustard seed is small. It will be big, and you said now, and wait, or later. Okay, I think that's good. Good summary of it. Mustard, we think of it as a weed, not too big. Apparently this plant would grow 8 to 10 feet tall, so birds could sit in. Certainly is a little seed to begin with. I know some people wear little lockets with these tiny seeds. Okay, so Jesus' followers, still quite small, still quite few. And what it says, how does it start? What is the parable supposed to be like? Kingdom of God. Okay, so he's saying now that the kingdom is indeed going to start small and going to become very big. Now little, then big. Now then. Okay, let's look at another seed parable, the one right before, number 3. Is that down here now? Is that you folks over here? Okay. That's the parable. How does it interpret what's happening?
Roof.
Okay. Okay, I heard growth and then I didn't hear the rest.
You stole my thunder. I was going to say growth and you already wrote that.
Oh, well, that's fine. We love to put things twice. Because that is indeed, if you talk about contrast here, contrast is growth. How does it, what would be the contrast here with the growth? Or?
The time span for the kingdom of God on this earth. Is that what it is?
Okay, what is the time span? Just expand that.
That's until the harvest, until.
Okay, it's again a now then, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the idea is it's happening now, automatically almost. Notice the contrast between the householder who is sleeping at night, up and around during the day. I mean, he's got a daily cycle, buzz, buzz, buzz. The seed is kind of very quietly growing along until the harvest, when then it will be harvested. We've got a now-then contrast and a slow growth, natural process versus the hustling, bustling of the householder. Yes?
Should we make anything of the fact that the householder does not know how the seed grows?
I think so. We might pick up that theme about hidden, I'll call it, hidden growth. He doesn't know, because we're going to find that that secret element, that hidden element is common. Okay, now we got some background. Let's go to the parable of the sower and the seed, the big one, number 1, this one. Okay, I'm going to write down what it is, and somebody start telling us how it relates to these themes that we're developing here in terms of interpreting.
Jesus is separating himself from the people, as exemplified by his being in the boat, maybe, and the people being on the shore, that there's a continuing separation. So,
okay, that's partly the result of this crowd of people, and he now teaches from the boat, separated off. What does he teach them about the kingdom here? What's going to happen? What's the contrast?
Different responses.
Different responses, okay. And while I'm writing that, what about those responses in terms of size and effect and so on?
30, 60, and
100%. What does that 30, 60, and 100% come from? What kind of soil? Good soil?
Good soil.
Okay, let's just, this is really an interesting parable, because when we hear it, we tend to say to ourselves, let's be good soil, right? We identify with the soils. Suppose we identify with the sower. Suppose Jesus is trying to tell us about what it's like when you become a disciple in the kingdom and you speak about the kingdom to other people. What does it tell you about the response? It says.
There'll be varied responses.
Certainly will be varied responses. How many different kinds of soils are mentioned there? Have you noticed?
Four.
Okay, suppose we just take roughly and say the sower sowing the same amount of seed. Suppose 25% then, 25% response. I mean, that Jesus doesn't say that. But then let's get back to this productivity. How much does that 25% produce?
30, 60, 100 fold.
So in a sense, Jesus says you can't tell the results by the number of people. You have to see the results in what the effect of the preaching is among those who in fact respond. And that can be much more than 25%. It can be, they make more than make up. Or whatever the details may be, do you see that we're building a kind of contrast business here between the present, which is small pickings, and lots of rejection, 3 to 1. And the future, which Jesus says the kingdom is going to turn out differently from the way it looks today. Yes?
What you bring up about the soil, too, the style of farming at that time was to do precisely this, throw the seed upon the ground and then go about cultivating it into the soil, rather than doing as we do nowadays, we prepare the soil first and then plant the seed. So the analogy at least holds true for...
That's wonderful, because, we built all our evangelism on the old revival system, which is that you're a great preacher or a great communicator, and you convince people that they ought to be saved, and they say, wow, yes. And there's this instantaneous conversion. And this is a much different picture. This is a picture of growth, a picture of cultivation after the seed is sown, before the harvest. Very different picture. I think it's good for us to remember that.
I think it's important that he threw the seed into all the soil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Very good. We'll find this happening, what Jesus does later in terms of his ability to indeed carry the message beyond the traditional soil. Okay, we've left out one group, and I know they're sitting there just panting to get in the act. Okay, 21 to 25. What would be the interpretation there that would help explain what's happening to Jesus or to the early church?
He's saying that once you're involved, you shouldn't go hiding.
Okay. This is the lamp. Okay, and this is reaction then. And it's openness. Don't hide your light under a bushel now. You can see it's what's ever hidden is revealed. And what about the second part of it?
The more you give, the more you get. And if you don't give, you lose it all.
Okay, and they're probably not talking, this is in verse 25, it's probably not talking just, it's not talking money, but is talking that that those with faith, those who begin as a seed, will grow in their belief. But those who, like the bad soil, just don't get started in this kingdom, will indeed lose any chance. So again, it's a contrast between present and future. So we've got quite a few contrasts here. Nice thing you can do, you can mark like this. Contrast. And this now, then, or now, later. And we certainly could say that with the sower and the seed as well. It takes a while for the seed to come up and hear. Now, do you see how chapter 4 helps carry the message forward as to what's going on? It helps us to see that the strange reaction to Jesus is, in fact, not wrong for the kingdom, but is, in fact, how the kingdom works. And if we are, therefore, in the early church or today, we perhaps might not think that the success syndrome is the way to judge how effective the ministry of the church may be, because of the hiddenness, because of the fact that God takes God's time to do things, and it can happen in a very natural way. Okay, Now we've come down to almost the end of chapter 4, and Jesus. Yes, sir.
A comment. I'm just sitting here thinking about a seed and what happens after it starts to grow and how it develops. Look around the room and see these pillars. They came from a microscopic seed because inside that seed, as tiny as it is, you have cells that are going to identify whether it's going to be a birch or an oak or a pine. That's the same thing that Jesus did when he started here on earth. So tiny, and look what happened since then.
Good model.
A tremendous movement in the world, all because of his microscopic beginnings that we're talking about today.
Well, and we're in a wonderful part of the country to see that. If you live in a territory as we do in Iowa, you get an 8-foot corn stalk, and you think that's pretty good for one little piece of corn. But look what you got out here. You're right. It's a very, very dramatic difference. Power in the seed, power in the Word of God. The kingdom of God works by its own power. Now, Jesus escalates the conflict. We're now going to look at chapter 5. And four, the end of four, because now there are four acts of power. Jesus now talks, he's talked, he's given them a little interpretation. Now we have, we're sort of, you know, we've had Jesus going around doing these healings and dealing with people who were sick, but now we have some surprising new events. I'm calling this section The Power of God Revealed. And I want to just review what they are, and then we're going to ask you to look at each one. They're familiar again. And answer two questions. Has Jesus' following increased? What is the reaction to Jesus' power? What are the questions or the responses? We're not going to spend a lot of time on the mechanics of each of these events, but more on the responses to begin to see first the power of Jesus and then the response. Now the first is Jesus' power over the storm. This is the calming of the storm. The Psalms speak about God as the one who rules the storm and the waves. And Psalm 89, for example. Here is Jesus who exercises that power of God. Then there is this interesting story of the Gadarene demoniac, the man who is possessed of an evil spirit living in Gerasa. Gerasa, as this text has it. There's some question as to where that is located, but it's Gentile territory. Jesus now moves out of Israel. This is the first sort of external action of Jesus, and it is a big one. It is a very powerful evil spirit, and Jesus does this outside of the typical Jewish territory, because there are swine present. No, it's not Jewish territory. Three, there is a story embedded in chapter 5 about a woman who is healed merely by touching Jesus' garment. Jesus doesn't even consciously act in her behalf, but she is healed anyway. That's sort of the power now radiating from Jesus. And then four, this familiar and long story about Jesus raising the son of a ruler of the synagogue. So I'd like you to do that, and we can use the same groups, I guess. Number one, then, power over the storm. Number two, over here, look at this interesting story about the pigs. Number three is the story embedded in that the story of the raising of the daughter of Jairus. And number four, folks upstairs, verses in chapter 5, verses 21 to 24, and then skip to 35 and 43. 21, 24, 35, 43. Just review the story. And the questions we want to look at is, has Jesus' following increased? And what is the reaction to his power in your story? What is the response to power? Thank you. finish yours, you can always read somebody else's story. It's fair. Look at these. Okay, first the power over the storm. What do we hear about Jesus? Following. Is there any reference to it?
Multitudes, ships, many boats.
Okay, multitudes. My book says crowd. And what was the reaction to Jesus' power by the disciples when they would see him?
Filled with awe.
What is the word used in your particular Bible?
Awe.
Terrified. What? Excuse me, I still haven't heard something.
Terrified.
Ooh.
Feared exceedingly.
Terrified. Feared.
Terribly afraid.
Afraid. Okay, now, and there was another frightened. Okay, notice that the reaction is getting a little more intense. It's not like they were amazed, which we heard frequently before, marveled. Now we're getting the impression that this was indeed a so awesome thing that it actually frightened people as to what who he was. Now, what do the disciples, how do they respond? What do they say?
I thought it was interesting that they still don't know who he is.
Okay, that's verse what? 41? 41?
41.
Okay. Who is this man? The identity question. Even the wind and the waves obey him. They see what happens, but they can't figure out yet the identity. The disciples can't. So we still have this puzzle. Okay, let's see how those themes then. I'm going to put a question mark here. Still a question. Now let's look at this story about the territory of Gerasa, or the Gadarenes, as it's sometimes called. Now let's notice Jesus here, first time outside of Judea, out of Jewish territory. What is the reaction here? What is the response of the people? Okay, that's verse 17, but it starts, so they asked Jesus to leave. Why do you think they wanted him to leave?
He was destroying their livelihood.
Business was bad, at least. Yeah, I mean, seriously, or let's say not seriously, I think a lot of these accounts, remember, these accounts circulated among people. The reason we have these is that people repeated these stories about Jesus, and then Mark and others collected them. So they were good stories, and this is one of the best, because they're talking Gentiles, first of all. Which is kind of nice, see, because they could say, well, watch what happens to the Gentiles, pagans. How many of them? What's the net loss here?
2,000.
2,000 pigs. It's a lot, even for our part of the country. That's a lot of dates. I couldn't figure out what, if anybody here knows what the price of pork was last year, you could figure out what the net loss was. And notice who had to tell the story about what happened. Who was the reporter of the story?
Those that were the herdsman.
Yeah, verse 14, the poor guy, I imagine they believe that, don't you? Sure, Charlie. All 2,000 ran into the lake. Right. Where were you? What were you doing?
Well, you know, there was a strange man.
Sure. And then what happened?
Well, you know, the guy that lives up there in the mountains and gets running around, and he's so strong. Well, he just came running out, and there's all this screaming and everything, and the pigs ran off into the lake.
So they said, okay, we'll go, and we'll have to talk to that guy and chase him back in the tombs. And they go up there, and what's the guy, the madman, doing? Sitting there, clothed in his right mind.
Hello, folks. Welcome. Yeah, glad to see you.
And then, what'd you do our pigs? Oh, gee. How you eating your pigs? They're nice. I like pigs very much. Okay, so he's fine. He's in his right mind, clothed. And what's the attitude then of the crowd beside wanting Jesus to leave?
We're afraid.
Okay. Is that what your text says? Afraid. Mine says something like that. Frightened, fear. Yeah? Okay, so they're afraid. It's not only that he's bad for business, that certainly must have been true, but they're also a bit awed at this. Okay, now what does Jesus, what happens now to the demoniac? Jesus deals with this event differently. By the way, we should have said, for those of you who didn't read the story, that the spirits again recognize him. This evil spirit says, what, Holy One of God, Son of the Most High. Son of the Most High God, yeah. So the demon again recognizes. That's the pattern we're used to. But the response now, Jesus had told the people, you know, the spirits, don't tell anyone and keep quiet about it. What is Jesus, what is the ending here?
Jesus asked the man to witness.
Yeah. Now, Jesus, for the first time, sort of gives permission for the man to go ahead and tell what happened to him. And in fact, in verse 20, it says, the man left and went through the 10 towns, telling what Jesus had done. Now, the word telling is pretty bland in English. The word there is the same word that is used in most of the New Testament for preaching, proclaiming. Kairouso. Preaching. So here is the first evangelist in the book of Mark. And it's presumably a Gentile, and one who had been demented at that. Okay, and then the end of the story is, and all who heard it were amazed. Again, we get amazement. Great, amazed. Okay, and here we get witness now for the first time, but it's to the Gentiles. All right, let's go on to the next then, which is healing by a touch. Folks who had that, tell us a little bit about what is the reaction of the woman to what happened to her.
She's well, afraid.
What?
She's afraid.
Afraid, verse? 33. Verse 33. The woman realized what had happened to her, so she came trembling with fear. You see, the reactions now are pretty serious. Trembling. Okay, and what does it say about Jesus' response, the following of Jesus? What do we have any hint about that here in this section?
Large crowd, multitude.
Okay, again, a crowd, a multitude. They can't, she can't get to him, and he doesn't know who touches him.
And don't the disciples actually kind of chide him a little bit and say, gee, the crowds are running so thick, who can even tell who touched him?
Yeah. We're getting, okay, this is our first hint of the disciples, and they're wonderful. Powerful help to Jesus in his ministry. They're always just right there doing not exactly what needs to be done.
Probably acting as secret service agent.
Very good. Stay away, please.
The thing is also they're expressing a disbelief that Jesus would know that there was, you know, some power in an exchange or that something had happened. How could you possibly know this?
Yeah, okay, so the disciples are a little, what?
Out to lunch.
Out to lunch, great, thank you. People always have good ideas. When I hear a laugh in the back of the crowd, I know that somebody has said it right. I just get it to the public. Okay. Now, this story occurs in the middle of a longer story, and Mark does this several times. It's a way to help, you know, meanwhile, passage of time. You have a little incident occur, and then you get back. Now, that's the story of the raising of Jairus' daughter. Okay, now let's look at that. That begins in 21. No. Yes, 21. And please notice now that that Jairus is identified in 22 as an official of the local synagogue. Here is the first break in the official authority's resistance to Jesus. Remember we talked about the kingdom being like a seed? Okay, here maybe is the seed. Here is the first Jewish official to come over. And he does so because he's just at his wit's end. He doesn't know what else to do. He's got a very sick daughter. And notice that it starts out that she is very sick, not dead. Then we have the story of the woman who is healed. Okay, now we get back. Folks upstairs, can you say anything about the measure of Jesus' following? Does it refer to Jesus' following here anywhere? To how big or small it may be?
It's so big you can't find the one person that touched his garment with all the people around him.
Yeah, I think there's no direct evidence in the Jairus story of the size, but that incident in the middle helps us because it makes it clear that there is indeed a tremendous crowd around him. Okay, so then that miracle occurs, and then the word comes that meanwhile the daughter of the ruler has died, verse 35. But Jesus now, again, contrary to normal attitudes and processes, says, in effect, don't worry, only believe. Now let's recall that would be a word to the early church, the early disciples, that would be just as meaningful as it was to Jairus himself and the crowd. Don't worry. Don't be afraid. Only believe. Okay, so then he goes and raises the child. Now in Jewish, there was a rabbinic saying that three things God alone could do. God had the power of the rain, the power of motherhood, and the power to raise the dead. God alone had those three powers. Jesus now takes her by the hand and says, little girl, I tell you to get up, and she gets up. And the reaction of the crowd was the other question. What is the reaction to the power? Anybody up there got the answer?
Amazed.
Okay, you know there's a crowd. Amazed. Now this is a smaller group, apparently. This is the group that was there in the room. It's not the whole crowd. And Jesus' reaction was, don't tell, the same we're familiar with. Okay, we've just come through a very powerful chapter, chapter 5. If you think back, Jesus has done things that tradition said only God could do. Had the power over the wind and the sea, cast out demons, heal, and raise the dead. Well, so then, one would expect chapter 6 to say, and the people rejoiced. But no. Chapter 6 picks up the other side of the conflict again, and notice that this is beginning to escalate. Chapter 6, Jesus comes back home, now trailed by the disciples. He comes into the synagogue, and notice the question asked in verse 2. Where did he get that? What wisdom is this that has been given him? How does he perform miracles? Those are the same questions the crowds were asking. The trouble was the people in their hometown had an answer. It's called The Closing of the Jewish Mind. Or, you know, there's this book, The Closing of the American Mind, that Americans have the quick, easy, and wrong solutions to every problem. So they do too. They answer the identity question right away. He's the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon. His sisters live here. Therefore, he couldn't be anybody. Nobody from this town that ever did anything very important. So they reject him. Note that, very flat. He is rejected in his hometown. He can do no miracles there, except a few sick people. And Jesus now, in 6, is greatly surprised because the people have no faith. Surprise, I suppose disappointed might be a word we would use today. So this is a sort of climax of popular rejection. Even, remember, his family was out to get him earlier. Now it's his hometown. They've all made their decision. He's a nobody, never be a somebody. He can't be doing this stuff, so we reject him. The evidence was there, but they knew Jesus, so they knew it couldn't happen. Jesus now responds by sending out the 12 disciples. Now the mission begins not only for Jesus, but we have this passage, a familiar one, in chapter 6, about the sending out of the 12. They go out 2 by 2. They are ordered to travel light and fast. Verse 11, if you come to a town where people don't welcome you or will not listen to you, leave it. In other words, there was no, this is the sower and the seed, you see. There's no effort to sit down in a rocky soil and try to make good soil out of it. It's not a Johnny Appleseed, I mean, it's not the approach that Johnny Appleseed avoided. If Johnny Appleseed had said, well, I'm going to plant an apple tree, and if it grows, I'll plant another one. And if it grows, I'll plant a third. He probably would have gotten through 3 apple trees in his life. He planted the seed, and he went on. And I suppose a lot of those apple trees never sprouted. But they were now to take the seed concept seriously. They are to speak and move on and let the word make its own harvest. Think back of chapter 4 and how it would be encouraging to them. The farmer does the, rises up, goes to bed, and the seed grows. So, verse 12, they go out and preach. And they follow Jesus' mission here. They preach that the people should turn away from their sins, that is, repent, and they drive out demons. So they are now beginning to experience the power of the kingdom. Now again, Mark does what he does so often. He inserts another story so that we have time. While the disciples are out on their ministries, we get the idea that time passes. And he tells now the story of King Herod. And this will be the end of our study today. It is simply to underline the fact that now opposition to Jesus and the question about his identity has come to the highest level, to King Herod. This is not Herod the Great. This is son, I think, of Herod the Great. Anyway, it's not the one who killed all the kids, all the babies. It is now another King Herod, and he has had John the Baptist irritating him for a long time. And now his bad conscience tells him that Jesus is John the Baptist come back. But notice the identity question is raised by Herod. Either he's Elijah or John the Baptist. And Herod's convinced he's John the Baptist. And if you read this story, which you all know well, this is the Salome story. If you read the story, you'll also notice that we begin to get a hint here of Jesus' own death. Because you have a ruler here who does not want to execute John. We have a ruler who is forced into that by circumstances sort of beyond his control. And we have then the disciples coming and taking the body of John for burial. So here in the middle of the power of Jesus, we have the first little rumbling, the first puff of eruption, so to speak, the first sign of the deadliness of the opponents. We now remember that there are people who have the power of life and death, and that they sometimes use that without being fully responsible or even consenting to that terrible power. So we come to the end of this section in which Jesus' power is shown, but also the opposition's power is made a bit more evident to us. Now, do you have some comments or questions? I've sort of drag us through it. In your reading, did you pick up some insights? It's sometimes fun to hear what you saw maybe for the first time and what you read. We have some time for that.
I'd like to comment.
Sure.
It seems that it's easy for me to look at these stories and think, you know, I would love to be on that boat, and since they would be so exciting to be on that boat, we're in the up and down, knowing that Jesus is going to make it stop. But we know the whole story. We already know, you know, the end of the story, and these people didn't know that yet. So you can see, for them, it was so frightening, but for us, it's so exciting.
Yeah.
It's just, it's hard. They have to really stop and think what their mindset was.
That's such an important thing to keep in mind when we read these stories, that these people are living through these events.
Yeah.
And that's the fear and the amazement. If you have ever, you've ever dealt with a strange religious phenomena, you get a little feeling for the uncertainty. And, you know, is this of God or is it not? That's right. We have the advantage. And so it's easy to be kind of snooty about the disciples, which I always am. Come down hard on them. Yes?
A lot of reference to demons here. What would we understand? How they fit in? Or who are the demons to whom he is talking? And the demons are talking back to him. How do we explain that to the 20th century?
It's pretty hard in Western society to do it because we have depopulated the supernatural world, so to speak, except for God. But in Africa, many parts of the world, this is their experience. This is the way they perceive life and reality, and they can still hear it that way. But it's really difficult. We've sterilized the laboratory. We've got all the germs out, and it's hard. It's really hard. Now, I think anyone who has dealt with mental illness, and many of us have had brushes with it, even senility, you get the feeling that there is a person there, but not the person you know. There is a response, but the response is so different. And sometimes those people have insights too. I mean, you know, we all have tales. We know a so-called sharp old lady. She seems so out of it most of the time, and then she'll look at you with that eye and say something, zingo, right to the heart of the matter. And I think our experience of the human mind is such that we can understand how, for them in those days, it was a very easy matter to personalize those strange voices and strange reactions. Okay, I'm saying that on the first level. I'm talking to scientifically trained U.S. citizens. I presume most of you are, or Westerners. Then I guess I would go on to say, and maybe we are the ones who have an impoverished worldview because we have depersonalized evil. We have a hard time with the devil and Satan. And if you have a hard time with it, if you depersonalize evil, then evil becomes something we can deal with. Then it becomes a thing like pollution. It becomes something that's humanly manageable. Because there's no will behind it. There's no alienness to it anymore. It's just something that you can get rid of like measles. And so maybe we're a little impoverished because we have not taken the full measure of what the ancient world knew so well, which was that maybe there are powers beyond human control. Now, that's just the other side of our scientific achievements, which have helped us so much. Maybe it has made us vulnerable on another side, because we really don't take seriously that alienness of evil. Yes?
There's a hymn in LBW, the Castor Nets, that talks about Fisher Bowman. And then in the last stanza of this, very bewildering, and maybe it could be demonic, I don't know. The peace of God, it is no peace, but strife closed in the side. Sorry to let this paper just one thing.
Much of our theme today. A couple of other comments over here. Yeah.
Isn't the demon question of making somewhat of a comeback in the witchcraft and the occult and all of these things that are becoming more and more popular here in society?
It's almost always the way we neglect something and then it comes out somewhere else and we have to cope with it again. you're certainly, we're hearing that other side of our scientific world, that there are people who are saying that's not the way, and all interest in Eastern religions. It's again kind of anti-Western, antiseptic and stainless steel and glass approach. Yes, sir.
In light of the parables in four, which all seem to be critical or at least suspicious of what you labeled the success syndrome, would you say something about TV preachers or the church growth movement or phenomena like that?
Well, I think they are really false gods and dead ends, really betray us. And you know, one of the things we all see, I think, and I, is that people who go into these things are so excited and so puffed up and thrilled about them. I think our ministry is the church that maybe doesn't fall off that side is to stay open to them, because they are going to get hurt. I think a lot of these Jim and Tammy Baker people now are really bewildered, and others are not, because there are always those who are going to say, you know, they're right. When the world didn't come to an end in the 19th century, there were all these predictions that the world would come to an end, and it didn't. They came back down, they recalculated, and they said, well, it's gonna come to an end a little later. Or they said it came to a spiritual end, or Jesus entered this heavenly sanctuary, and they got an explanation, and they move on. And I think we just have to continue to witness to these people that maybe Jesus is challenging us to more than Mercedes and offspring, but also be ready to help them when the crash comes, because it does tend to come. And I think we have a faith for the long haul, faith that can live us through some of the difficulties. Maybe they're experiencing some of that seed that falls in the shallow soil that sprouts up very quickly and looks good, but when drought comes, it's not too healthy.
You spoke of the leadership as being sort of false gods, false. Okay, but how about the people, the followers? Are there not faithful among the followers who are not false faithful?
Sure. Sure, the crowd is going to be a mixed crowd. We're going to see that. There are, they're just like the soil, I think. They're going to be those who follow Jesus to the end, who appear at the crucifixion, then with him. The disciples are that same kind of off again, on again group, but they're going to end up faithful. That's why their names are recorded and continue to be talked about. Even the authorities, some of them are going to come over. We've seen one now. You remember in John's Gospel, there's this amazing Nicodemus, who is a powerful Jewish figure, appears early in John's Gospel and then appears again at the crucifixion. So, there are the faithful already here. The soil is going to produce. Okay, I think the general glassy nature of your stares. Now, tomorrow we're going to start looking more at the disciples, because the story now turns from these great crowds and begins to focus on the disciples and their struggle with Jesus. Okay?
Yeah, we must take our celebration.
This is a guy from,